Certain kinds and presentations of food are expected from certain cultures. England, for example. If you ask many people what's on the table, they might say tea first. But tea is not native to the British Isles and was unknown to Brits until a few centuries ago. That is one obvious way in which the change from islands to empire changed the diet of the Brits and many other people in many parts of the world. The changes are tracked in the book The Taste of Empire, How Britain's Quest for Food Shaped the Modern World. It is the work of Lizzie Collingham, a historian who taught at Warwick University, pronounced the British way, and did research at Jesus College, Cambridge, before going independent. She's the author of three previous books, including The Taste of War. Lizzie Collingham, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
It's a pleasure.
So how did food become such a central focus of your research?
Well, I started off by doing my PhD a long time ago on the British body in India and how you use your body as a tool for representing your power and as a tool of rule, in a way. And that involved washing and clothing and eating. And so that way I got into food and ended up writing a book on curry and the history of the British relationship with Indian food and stuff. So I kind of fell into food by accident.
Is this a fairly common thing, though, that when a company does begin trading far and wide across the world, and of course taking places over as well, that it's going to bring back the foods from the places that it's trading with?
Absolutely. I mean, the thing was, it was actually the Dutch who started. So the Dutch East India Company, set up in about the same time as the English East India Company, they really started picking up tea. And you'd get tea, they would bring tea to India, and the British learned that you could drink tea from them, and then they started to go to China and pick up tea and bring it back. And it became a kind of very high status thing. And obviously it was probably green tea, not black tea, that early tea. And it was wonderful because you could import as well those lovely thin porcelain, beautiful cups, which of course the British didn't have at the time. Europe didn't know how to make porcelain at the time. So it was this very status, high status symbol thing. And then it gradually becomes more and more common and more starts appearing and it becomes more affordable and more people are able to drink it. And of course the British start putting tea in it, sugar in it. Nobody knows when, but it's probably a British thing that you drink sugar in your tea.
It's very interesting to think about not just the tea itself, but the things we put in it and what we put it into all sort of came along together. These are things that were not initially British at all.
No, and it was all a kind of, so you'd have, ladies would have in their cabinet there, the special little cupboard where they kept their special things. They'd have a tea caddy, which they could lock so their servants couldn't nick a drink, any tea and drink it, because it was expensive at the time. And it was all part of a lovely, luxurious set of oriental exotic things that you could have. And then it, obviously, I mean, by the 18th century, it's still seen as a luxury by the middle classes, but they start complaining that even road sweepers and labourers and haymakers are drinking tea instead of drinking beer. And that's because, but they didn't understand, that's not because it was a luxury, that's because they were poor and they couldn't afford the fuel to brew their own beer. And so tea was an alternative, and tea by then was sold in little shops. And little shops spring up in 18th century Britain for the first time. You don't have shops before that. And you get little village shops selling tea and tobacco and sugar. And that's all sold together. And so the working classes and the laboring classes started to drink tea. And tea replaced beer with the rural laborers.
Several interesting things here in just this part about tea. And obviously there's much more to the book than just tea. But the idea that this was not just ultimately for the tables of the rich, that it was adopted by people who were laboring in all sorts of tasks. And it seems like you're saying in the book that the food of empire, in essence, powered the Industrial Revolution.
Well, in some ways, so what happens is more and more tea comes into Britain, so it becomes more and more affordable, and these little shops set up, and in a way, so people worked harder, because if you took in work as a woman, particularly the women's labour in the 18th century, so apart from labouring in the fields for the farmers, they would also take in spinning for those proto-industrial beginnings of the textile industry, and they would earn enough money to be able to buy a few luxuries. The first thing you bought was a feather bed, because people wanted to sleep comfortably, but they also then started buying themselves a screw of tea, a bit of sugar, a ribbon to put in your hair. And so it's all the colonial goods are all part of that change towards a sort of consumer society. And that is one of the engines that fuels the change towards the Industrial Revolution. It's one of the dynamics. And of course, the trade starts, if you have an East India company, you need shipping, you need people to build the ships, you need people to insure the ships and the cargo, you need banks to extend them credit and so on. So it begins that whole financing and industry, and it lays down many of the foundations for what becomes the Industrial Revolution.
I'm curious, too, about the comment you made about shops, that until tea came along and you could have a place to buy your tea and your sugar and all that stuff, that there really weren't shops like that previously.
No, not really. So before that, you'd grow your own food, or you'd go to the local market if it was held, you know, in your market town, and buy your food from a market store, or you might go to an annual fair and buy some gingerbread or a few luxuries, but there weren't shops. But in the 18th century, little shops start springing up. I mean, or there are shops that sell hardware. So there's one in Wales, and that served a huge area. People would travel for miles to go there and buy, I don't know, things to paint their wood with so it didn't rot, and hardware and hose and stuff. But he then stocked this chap a few bits of tea and some ribbons and some lace, and the women would come with the wives would come with the husbands and buy themselves some tea and sugar. And often in his account book, you can see he's written down "nor to tell," and it means don't tell the husband that the wife had bought these little things. So, and little shops sprang up all over, and often the backbone of these little shops was tea and sugar.
We will talk much more with Lizzie Collingham, the historian, about her book, The Taste of Empire, How Britain's Quest for Food Shaped the Modern World, back on the Jefferson Exchange with Lizzie and your phone calls and emails in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the British historian Lizzie Collingham, on the phone from England, talking to us about her book, The Taste of Empire, How Britain's Quest for Food Shaped the Modern World. All those things we expect on the British table now got there through empire and through bringing foods in from other corners of the planet. And it changed not just England, but lots of other places in the world as well. So yes, tea and sugar. Yes, imperialism and slavery as well, all wrapped up in this book. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. The chapter structure in the book is fun and seems almost like individual meals that we're seeing here. And it begins with fish in Newfoundland and Canada. This, you say this is the foundation of the British Empire. Lizzie, how?
Well, lots of people think that the first time the British went off sailing in search of spices, that began the empire when they set up the East India Company and went off. But actually, before that, they were looking for a sea route to the East Indies, and they couldn't find it. And a chap called Jean Cabot set off from Bristol and sailed. Which way did he sail? East, hoping to, or was it west?
West.
And looking for a sea route. And he used a lot of the know-how of the fishermen who were in Bristol at the time. And they were used to sailing across the Atlantic. And they probably did know that there were lots of fish over there. And so he's gone off to look for the sea route. He doesn't find the sea route. Instead, he finds off the coast of Newfoundland an incredible number of cod, which they're seething in the sea. So the first people who got there, they described how you couldn't row a little boat through the seas very easily because the seas were so heaving with fish that the oars wouldn't go through the water. So it was incredible. So that then started off, a lot of West Country fishermen started going. They'd go in the spring, they'd sail across and set up a little fishing station, dry the cod, salt it down, and bring it back at the end of the summer and sell it to the Spanish and to the Navy and army victuallers to feed their troops and the marines and so on. So that But by beginning that trade, they understood then the triangular trade, that you could exchange the cod in Spain for wine and bring it back to Britain. They didn't want the cod so much as the wine. And so there's a kind of triangular trade thing. And then also you build up a body of people who are used to sailing across the seas and, you know how to navigate the sea currents and the winds across the Atlantic. Because often when you want to sail somewhere, it's very counterintuitive which direction you should actually sail. So when you went to India, actually you sailed to Brazil first and then caught the winds to go the other way. So it's, you know, you have to build up knowledge about that. So Newfoundland lays down a lot of the knowledge that you need in order to then become the master of the oceans, as the British eventually did.
Now, with all that cod, and at that time no ice machines, they had to find a way to preserve it, so there's a lot of salting of the cod. What did that do to the flavor of the fish, as reported by the people of the time?
Well, no, I mean, the you can still buy salt cod in the Mediterranean. In fact, I was on holiday in Croatia last year, and I was amazed in the supermarkets they had salt cod. And lots of it. And a friend of mine is Spanish, and she makes salt cod. It's delicious. So it's not, I mean, it doesn't seem nice. It's quite salty. So you get it as dry as a board, but you soak it in water for a long time, and then it reconstitutes and becomes a very delicious codfish dish. It's really, really nice. But it looks like you could, you know, kill someone with it because it's so hard when you actually buy it. So that was very clever way. Many of the Norwegians started by drying the cod. And then in Iceland, the West Country fishermen developed the technique of salting it as well and then drying it in the wind. It's a really brilliant way to preserve fish, tasty fish.
Yeah, I did not know much of the history of Newfoundland itself. There was an Aboriginal population there. What happened to them?
That was a really tragic story. So they were very shy, and they didn't. When the fishermen started setting up on the shores, they moved inland because they didn't want to encounter these strange people. And unfortunately, there isn't much to eat inland, and they weren't hunters of game. They were really people who lived by fishing and catching seals and things in the sea. So they eventually became extinct. They died out. I don't know quite how to pronounce the name, the Beotuck, or I don't think that's quite how you pronounce it, Beotuck. Mm-hmm. But those were the first indigenous people on Newfoundland. They died out as a result of the West Country fishermen arriving.
Lizzie Collingham is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is The Taste of Empire, How Britain's Quest for Food Shaped the Modern World. We get to Ireland in Chapter 2 and a Brit who is barely holding back the gagging. What were the circumstances that John Dunton ended up in this country cottage in Ireland?
That's kind of a bit disgusting. That meal made me laugh so much. Because he's an eccentric bookseller in London, and he falls out with his second wife, and he just decides to go to Ireland to get away from her, I think, and writes about it and makes some money by writing about it. Anyway, so he goes to Connaught. So Connaught is kind of seen as the wild west of Ireland. The English had taken over Ireland and planted English farmers there and tried to so-called civilize them, and instead of being nomadic cattle farmers, they wanted them to settle down in villages and farm like a low country English farmer. And those Irish who resisted or who were Catholic were pushed west. And so Connaught was seen as the sort of that last bastion of the barbaric old Irish in this sort of terribly prejudiced way. And so he visits Connaught, and he describes going to stay with some people living there, and they catch a hare on the way, and then they say, oh, they're very hospitable, and they make him a syllabub by milking the cow in front of him, and then they set about making him oatcakes by actually grinding the oats in front of him. And he describes how the woman hefts up her skirts, and she's got nothing on under the skirts, and he's no shrinking violet, this guy, but he says he didn't know where to look. And then she makes the butter, and she churns the milk, by using her hand as the butter churn. And then he says it makes her, you know, the sweat trickle down from her armpits into the butter, and he can't eat a thing. It is a really funny meal. I just put it in because it made me laugh so much.
It made me laugh as well. But the Brits ultimately held their noses in their gorge because Ireland was very important to them for trade purposes. Why?
Absolutely. Well, basically, Ireland does become an extremely productive farm area, and they produce beef and butter, both of which they salt down and put into barrels, and the ships going out to the West Indies, by that point the English have colonies in Barbados growing the sugar that they're going to put in their tea, and they take beef and butter out to the planters, the white planters living there, and they subsist on, I mean, all their meat more or less comes from Ireland, because there's nothing left on Barbados once they start planting sugar, because it's so profitable. They cut down all the trees, and there's no point in giving up land to cattle. You might as well import your food and export your sugar. So that's how Ireland becomes a really important, and they also export salt pork to Newfoundland and the fishermen, and there's a beginnings of a kind of settlement there, and a proper colony is there as well. So Ireland feeds the empire and feeds the navy as well with salt beef and butter.
So ultimately, I mean, England essentially thought it had to hold these places because these were really its larder, its food supply.
Eventually, I mean, it's just they want it for trade, and it's all part of it. What happens is the British Empire is this kind of incredible network of connections and a web, and so after a while, one place depends on another. So the West Indies depend on Ireland for their salt beef, and they depend, and then Argentina depends on South Wales coal for their fuel, and so it becomes this incredible web. And by the end of the empire, by the beginning of the 20th century, the working classes in Britain are fed on New Zealand lamb and butter and cheese and Argentinian chilled beef and Canadian wheat. So all of these places set up and export food, and Britain exports its labourers who used to grow the food back out to those places to grow food on Australian or Canadian plains rather than at home. So and the rest are making the goods, the manufacturers in the empire, in the industries that they sell to buy the food. So it's an incredible web that develops.
It truly is, and we learn a lot about that whole web and all the interconnections in Lizzie Collingham's book, The Taste of Empire, How Britain's Quest for Food Shaped the Modern World. We're learning about tea, sugar, cod, dairy products from Ireland, beef from Argentina, you name it. We've gone through a long list already. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Your thoughts, comments, questions, maybe some other stories you remember from your own youth about hearing about where your food came from in the world. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone. By email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. You did mention Barbados briefly. Let's go all in on sugar in Barbados. It was not the first crop of choice. What sorts of things had they done that had failed before sugar?
Well, 50 adventurous young men arrived on Barbados in, I've forgotten the exact date, in the early 17th century. And by that point, there were no indigenous people living there. It was a completely unpopulated island. And they decided they were going to set up a colony. And Virginia, by that point, was pretty successful in growing tobacco. So they just thought, okay, we'll set up and grow tobacco, our own cash crop. But the tobacco that they grow is not very good. So John Winthrop, who set up the migration to New England, at that point he's still in England. One of his sons goes out to Barbados. He's one of these first 50 men. He sends back the tobacco to John, and he writes back to him, don't send me any more. It's wet and moldy, and I can't sell it, and it's just rubbish, and I can't give you any more money because, you know, you're too much of a drain. I've got all these other children. So the tobacco doesn't work. So they try cotton. They try dyes. They try all kinds of things, and then finally a chap called James Drax goes to Brazil, where the Portuguese have big sugar plantations, and he observes how rich the planters there there are and how well the sugar does. And he brings back sugarcane and the technology. And it takes them a while to learn how to do it. It's complicated to grow sugar. You have to wait. It's an 18-month cycle, not a yearly cycle, before you can harvest it and so on. It's hard work. And refining it, you have to grind the juice out and then boil it down to make the sugar and so on. So, but his sugar is really successful. So he quickly discovers that 1 acre planted with sugar makes 4 times the amount of money an acre planted with tobacco. And very quickly, all the other planters follow suit and copy him. And before you know it, they've cut down every tree. They've created this incredible monoculture on Barbados. So there's nothing left except for sugar plantations, and so that's, you know, that's why they want to import the food, because they can't give up it, they afford to give up the land to grow crops. They want to just grow the sugar, and it becomes the richest part of the island in the British Empire for some time, because sugar is so valuable and is so popular in Britain, and that's how the British really start to integrate sugar into their diet, because it imports so much. There's so much coming in that it becomes affordable, and more people are able to integrate sugar into their food.
Lizzie, how radical was that thinking for that point in history? We're talking 17th century here, I guess, that they would make a conscious decision, we're not going to grow our own food here, we're going to bring it in from someplace else.
Now, that's more... That's later that they make that.
Right.
It's not so much of a conscious decision, but it sort of happens because of the Industrial Revolution. People they don't need so many people on the land. There's an agricultural revolution, so that sort of happens sort of inadvertently as a byproduct. But those first plantations, that was the whole point for the British. The whole idea of setting up a colony, a plantation, was that it would grow cash crops in some way that would be in some way useful to the mother country. So that's why you have the tobacco. And so that's why they send out people to colonize the Americas in order to grow cash crops. Of course, they initially go hoping for silver and gold, like the Spanish had discovered, but then they don't discover it. So they decide that it would be better if they, in effect, the tobacco and the sugar are a form of gold, because you can export them to the rest of Europe and make money that way.
Lizzie Collingham, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, British historian with a book called The Taste of Empire, How Britain's Quest for Food Shaped the Modern World. So you mentioned how big an industrial process it is to grow and refine sugar, which takes a lot of labor. What did it mean to be Barbadosed?
Oh, that was eventually they employ slaves to do the horrible job of growing the sugar, but first they use in white indentured labor. So the poor, the vagrants in Britain or convicts are rounded up and sent and offered £5 if they work on a sugar plantation for 5 years, and it's really hard work and dangerous. You could get drawn into the rollers and lose your hand, or get burnt or scalded by the boiling sugar and so on. So to be Barbados was, during the Cromwellian wars in Ireland and in Britain, England rather. So they sent royalists and Irish rebels to Barbados as, in effect, slaves. To work the sugar plantations, and they were Barbados because they could never come back, so they were sent to Barbados for good. So that's what it's a great term, isn't it? And then eventually, in the slave ships that are going from West Africa to Portugal to take slaves in the Portuguese slave trade to work on their sugar plantations in Brazil, they start stopping over in the West Indian on the West Indian islands, and the British planters start buying slaves. And eventually, the Africans replace the white indentured laborers on the plantation.
Now, there is a key point of history to pick up here when we talk about the African slave trade, because you talk about the French and English and other European countries showing up, but you say they did not create the slave trade.
There was a slave trade already, a very, very strong slave trade across the Sahara Desert to the northern African coast and around the Mediterranean. So the Africans were already selling people they captured in war or in raids into a slave trade already. And so those early Europeans who stop over on the coast, they just pick up and feed into the slave trade. And of course, the more demand you have, the more you create the wars and so on to provide slaves. So it mounts up and gains momentum as a result of the huge drain of West Africans to the Americas.
Well, and that required actually bringing some food to West Africa. Is that part of this too?
Well, the whole point is if you've got a lot of people who you've captured inland and you take them to the West African coast and then you wait for the ships to come to be able to load them, and then those ships have got to feed these people as they go on the Middle Passage across from West Africa to the Americas. So you need a lot of food. So the Africans started to plant maize, which you can grow two crops of maize in the time that you can grow one crop of millet, and it stores well, and cassava as well. They plant cassava, and those are South American or American food crops, and they come in with the Portuguese, and they're introduced into West Africa, and they take off like wildfire because they're used to feed the slave trade. They're used to feed the slaves. And now in West Africa, people refer to maize as the ancestors. They think maize is an indigenous crop to Africa. They think it's their crop, their food. But actually, it's a product of the slave trade.
All right, much more to talk about maize and corn in particular, as we go through more of Lizzie Cullingham's book, The Taste of Empire, How Britain's Quest for Food Shaped the Modern World. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Lizzie and you in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about food here on the Exchange today, but not in a recipe sort of sense. Although, honestly, there are some recipes in this book, but it's a book of history about how the British quest for empire also brought all sorts of new foods to the British table over the years. When you stop to think about it, that whole routine that the Brits have with tea and sugar, neither tea nor sugar were known to Brits in the time of the first Queen Elizabeth. A lot changed in the course of empire. And Lizzie Cullingham, the historian, brings this all to the front in her book, The Taste of Empire, How Britain's Quest for Food Shaped the Modern World. This is a conversation you're more than welcome to join on the Exchange. 800-838-3760 with your questions and comments. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about maize, corn, and how prevalent it got to be in many different parts of the world. In West Africa, you remarked it's referred to as an ancestor crop, which is viewed as indigenous, and it's not. There's another story earlier in the book about maize bread being served in New England. Joseph Holloway is portrayed in Massachusetts, and it seems like eating bread from corn was a bit of a come down for a Brit.
Yeah, so the way I've organized the book is to every chapter begins with a meal, and then I unpick that meal. I ask, how could that be? How are these circumstances possible? What did the people think of the food they're eating? Or so on. And so Joseph Holloway is a New England settler. He comes over in that great migration in the 1630s. The first settlers regarded maize as kind of pig food. They thought it was animal food. What they wanted to do was come over to New England and become yeoman farmers. It was becoming more and more difficult to be a yeoman farmer in Britain because many farmers were being marginalized and pushed out. So the dream was to come to New England, have your own land, plow your fields, and be a proper upstanding farmer. However, the problem is you have lots of land in America, but you don't have much labor. So, you know, you have to cut down the trees and dig up their roots. It was really hard work. So what they ended up doing was growing half of their land because they really needed food, just like the Native Americans grew their food. So they would just burn the forest down, chop down the few trees, and then grow the maize in among the stumps. And then in between the maize plants, they'd grow squash and beans and so on. And it all looked terribly messy and untidy. And the British hated that, but they ended up having to do that themselves because that was the most efficient way of farming in New England. And so that's why many settlers would serve cornbread rather than wheat bread. And wheat got rust and was useless. You couldn't. It was really, really difficult to establish wheat on the American continent because now it seems like it seems almost like an indigenous crop to America, but of course it was introduced by the English settlers. So that's why they developed all kinds of ways of eating cornbread. And also rye grew much better, so they would often mix cornbread with rye, which is why you get rye and Indian and bread, and which is kind of a heavy dairy. I mean, you probably still eat it in New England, I don't know. And baked beans, because of course beans were very Native American. But that becomes seen as this symbol of a great upstanding New Englander. They turn what at first is a bit of a humiliation to eat into symbols of their strength and they see them as symbols of their success.
You know, the book works on so many different levels. I did mention there are actual recipes in here in addition to descriptions of meals. I mean, we can certainly look at the imperial and the slaveholding history in here, but also there's even science to get into that stuff we didn't know about, like a pellagra, which is a deficiency disease caused by eating corn a certain way. What goes on there?
Well, the trouble is that the Mesoamericans and Native Americans, they knew how to prepare corn. So the problem with maize is that the nutrients in it, the vitamins and the protein, are locked in and they're very undigestible. But if you soak the corn kernels in lye beforehand and then boil them, it somehow breaks the nutrients down so that they're accessible to the human digestion, and then maize is a good thing to eat. But they don't take that technology with them when they take maize to West Africa. And so you just, the West Africans just boil the maize kernels, and they don't know to soak it in lye first. And so they don't have the same access to the nutrients. And that's how lots of children, they appear to be eating well and eating plenty, but they're not getting the nutrients. They get kwashiorkor and protein deficiency diseases and malnutrition. It's a really sad legacy of maize's transport. Whereas cassava, they do transport, because, you know, cassava is really difficult to get out. You have to grate it and let the poison drip out of it and then dry it.
It really is toxic. You're not kidding about this.
Yeah, no, it's really toxic. It's prussic acid or something in there. But in order to transport that, you have to take the technology. So they do take that technology to West Africa, Angola and so on. And they learn how to prepare cassava properly. But sadly, that with maize, that knowledge doesn't come. And it's the same problem that they take it to Italy as well without the knowledge of how to prepare it. But that's why corn is so great in, you know, Mexican tortillas and so on. They're really nutritious. But it brings a problem with it to Europe and Africa.
There's a moment in here in the first part of the book where Samuel Pepys and his wife sit down to a meal in 1667, and it's a bit of a French meal is the way they characterize it. What was French about it?
Well, I mean, I love Pepys's meal. He takes his wife to a French, as they called it, ordinary, which is then termed for a restaurant, because they've had a row about her wearing a wig with white locks on, which he seems really jealous of. I think it's because her dancing master thinks she looks nice and he's really jealous. So they have a quarrel, and he takes her out for a meal. And the point is, in that period, in late 17th century England, because it was just after the Restoration, and the English king had been in exile in France, and he brought back a fashionable francophilia. He brought back a fashion for French food. And the French at that point were rejecting spices. So spices were pouring into Britain with the East India Company, but the high status people were rejecting it and saying, oh, no, we want to be able to just taste the flavor of the main ingredient, and spices are no longer seen as a high status food. And so that's why French cuisine is seen as something special, and that's why Pete takes his wife out to it. And also the whole idea of eating your dinner in courses and having dinner parties, that was all came out of the French salons, and that was coming over to England and was very fashionable at the time.
Wow. So the food, the drink, the porcelain in which you serve the food and drink, the method of serving the food and drink, all these things change on the British table over the course of a couple of centuries.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, yes, absolutely. And they keep on changing. They never, food, that's the point about food. Food's really fascinating because it's restless and it's constantly fusing. And we often think, oh, that was a traditional dish. And then you start to unpick it and you just realize, oh, it's not that traditional at all. And actually, it's only been around for 20, 30 years and it comes out of this process or that process. And so vindaloo, for example, we think of that as completely Indian, but it's actually the result of Portuguese taking a taste for marinated meat marinated in vinegar to Goa, and then in Goa bringing chilies from South America and then putting Indian spices and pepper together, and then you get what people think of as an Indian dish, but it's a fusion. And food is always doing that, and so that's one of the reasons why I like looking at food. And every meal, you can take any meal and start to unpick it, and you find a history and a story. And so I really love tracing all of that.
See, the idea of fusion in meals, which we think ourselves clever for doing now, has actually been around pretty much as long as food has been around, from the sounds of it.
We've rebranded it and made it sound as though it's something we have, new, but it isn't. No, it's been there forever.
So I want to cover a little more ground on spices here, because you mentioned them briefly in passing, but when did those begin to arrive in England, and was that something, again, that the aristocrats got first and then spread to the lower classes?
Well, the thing was with spices is that spices have been coming in from on the Silk Route, so across and up the Red Sea and into the Middle East, and then it was traded by Arabs with Venice, and it was brought from Venice to Antwerp, and then that from Antwerp to England. So spices, by the time they got here, were pretty valuable and high status. So it was extremely fashionable to eat complex, sophisticated, very layered food. The flavors were very layered. If you eat very good Indian food, it's got lots and lots of sophisticated levels of taste in it. And that was really, really fashionable among the elites in the Renaissance and so on. But as I was saying, by the 1660s, by the time of the Restoration, the French had rejected all of that. They were starting to go for simpler foods, and also the way they thought digestion worked had changed. So it used to be that you thought that the stomach cooked your food, and spices were very good for cooking your food because they had heat in them, so they helped cook the food. But then they changed their minds about what the stomach is doing. They say, oh no, the stomach is fermenting the food you eat. And spices are no longer seen as quite so good for that, so you want things like mushrooms and anchovies and asparagus to ferment your food. So spices fall out of favor and among the elite. But they become more affordable. So, and like sugar, sugar is seen as one of the spices. So in the 18th century, there's a botanist, he complains that the in the rural areas, people still murder bacon and eggs in the dressing. And what he means is they sprinkle brown sugar on it. And if that was really fashionable, you'd sprinkle sugar on any food in Elizabethan period, Renaissance period, and it was seen as this perfect food. It would make any food just right for any constitution, any melancholic, sanguine, and so on. But sugar also falls out of favor with the spices, and they get pushed into this out of the savory. So you get this divide, savory at the beginning, and then sugar and spices in cakes and sweets and puddings at the end. But the laboring classes can afford spices now because they're coming in such large quantities with the East India Company, and they start putting a few spices in their puddings and stuff. So they're still eating meat puddings flavored with cloves and nutmeg, but the upper classes are pushing them into the dessert course area. So it's happening on many different levels. And then spices aren't so popular in England, but they're incredibly popular still in Eastern Central Europe. So in fact, many travelers complain, upper-class travelers complain that the food is thick with spices if you go there, and so they make money by selling the spices that they brought in from the East Indies on their ships to Eastern Europe and so on. So there's, it never stops. It's a restless world, but it's always moving about and changing.
The book is illustrated, including with many trade cards. I mean, and I just wonder how common people were, how aware they were of where their food came from.
Well, I think with the trade cards, you couldn't avoid knowing that tobacco came from North America, and you often have Indians wearing feathered headdresses and smoking pipes to sell tobacco, and there are often slaves rolling barrels around, so you couldn't help but know that that was associated with slavery.
And did that trouble people at all, I wonder?
Pardon?
Did that trouble people at all to know that their food came from slave handling?
Over time, it gradually begins to trouble people, and people stop they don't want to buy slave-grown sugar when there's the movement for the abolition of slavery. So it does begin to trouble people, but very gradually. It's only over time that you realize. And sugar, interestingly, isn't sold on those trade cards with images of where it comes from or images of slavery. You just see sugar cones, but they don't push that with the slavery. I don't know whether that's because of the sensitivity or just because sugar just seemed like a good that didn't matter where it came from, because the quality of tea might vary according to where it came from and where it was grown and in China. So you want to show that it's authentic, whereas sugar just tasted like sugar wherever it came from. So I don't know. But in the end, yes, there's the movement towards the abolition of slavery in 1838 in the British Empire. Slavery is eventually, because of the humanitarian movement, abolished.
Lizzie, about a minute left, and it seems like as you read the book, there's a sense of a real British sense of adventure about food. But, you know, the British sense of adventure about food the British food was universally regarded as fairly dull until just a few decades ago. And I wonder if that had a lot to do with the loss of empire and rationing during World War II.
I think it didn't help, and the British aren't very good cooks. That's why they kept on bringing foods in. So I think, you'll have stories of people traveling in 17th century England saying, oh, they can't cook. So I think the British have never really been able to cook. They've always had to look for foods elsewhere to make their food more interesting.
Wow, this is a really interesting look at the world. Like I said, it operates on many levels. You can use it as a recipe book, you can use it as a science book, you can use it as a history book. It is called The Taste of Empire, How Britain's Quest for Food Shaped the Modern World. It is the work of Lizzie Collingham in Cambridge, England. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
It's a pleasure.
All right, take care.